QSO Today, Episode 11, Wayne Burdick, N6KR. Welcome to the QSO Today podcast. I'm your host, Eric Guth, 4Z1UG. My guest today is an old friend, literally since we were both teenagers at the El Cajon Amateur Radio Club in El Cajon, California. And while we have been friends for over 40 years, we do not get to QSO very often. I'm pleased to welcome to QSO Today, Wayne Burdick, N6KR. Many of my listeners may know Wayne as the co-founder, along with Eric Swartz, WA6HHQ, of Elecraft. Wayne is Elecraft's CTO and the creator of the Elecraft line of amateur radio transceivers. Since QSO Today is about amateur radio stories, we will let Wayne tell about his own journey. N6KR, this is 4Z1UG. You there, Wayne?
4Z1UG from N6KR. I am indeed here.
Yeah, I'm absolutely delighted to have you on, Wayne. And actually, you were. I've had people send me messages saying, "Hey, when are you going to have Wayne N6KR on?" So now I'm glad I've got you.
So I'm honored.
Let's start at the very beginning, Wayne. How did you discover amateur radio?
Well, maybe the right answer to that question is, how did I first get interested in electronics? Because that happened at a very early age, and the amateur radio part of it was a little bit of a spur. So I was ripping apart radios at a very early age, probably from maybe age six. We had a nice clean garage until I discovered that I could clip the little parts out of ancient radios and TVs, and I started collecting them in bins. I didn't quite know what to do with them yet, but that was really the beginning of the whole thing. And along the way, I did some dubious experiments. For example, I once plugged a very large permanent magnet speaker directly into the 120-volt wall outlet to see what that would sound like. And believe me, you don't want to do it. You get a very, very loud 60 hertz buzz for about 5 seconds, and then the speaker blows up. And, I tried to make a TV from sheets of glass, things that you can expect a six-year-old to do. But then when I was eight, my dad bought me the first of a series of Radio Shack Science Fair project kits. You remember those?
Yeah, absolutely. I had the same.
Right. So this one, the very first one I got was one of those little red plastic perf boxes with a clear plastic cover. And it was an eight-note electronic organ. Mm-hmm. Now, I think my dad probably figured out that I was going to be an engineer because I stayed up till something like 11 o'clock soldering that thing together. And when I first turned it on, hooked up the 9-volt battery, it sounded like an organ, but the notes were out of tune. And I spent a whole bunch more time figuring out that if I could just change the resistor values a little bit, I could actually get it in tune. I was blessed or cursed, as you might, imagine, with a good musical ear. So I knew they were out of tune, and that's how I learned about paralleling and series combinations of resistors in order to change their values. So when I was a little older, maybe age 10, I was up the street at a friend's house and noticed that there was a huge antenna next to his house. It was his dad's antenna, and he took me inside the house. This was the Smiths. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Smith had a huge room that was filled with gear. I believe it was Collins gear. I didn't understand anything about radio gear at the time, but there was some very impressive things, like a very large floor-standing amplifier and an ASR-28 teletype terminal. This guy was a real pro, and his walls were covered with QSL cards. So that's when I first got interested in radio. I had no idea what he exactly was up to, but then his dad came in and made a contact with somebody in Australia, and I was pretty much hooked.
Amazing. Do you happen to remember Mr. Smith's call sign?
Or I don't. He wasn't at the club. He was not a club member in El Cajon. I'm pretty sure of that. That I discovered later.
So when did you get to the point where you took your first test?
That was in junior high. So infamously, I actually failed the novice exam the first time I took it because the science teacher, Mr. Roger Miller and Dick Leffler, taught the science class. They were the ones who ran the club at Parkway Junior High. And they pretty much put the emphasis on learning code. And somehow we were supposed to learn the regulations and technical details through osmosis, I suppose, maybe just as members of a science class. And so we all took the test, and very few of us actually passed because we hadn't studied the license manual. So then we cracked the books out and we actually did pass the test. But Parkway Junior High had a very nice radio club and a radio room, and it was there that I made my first QSO. This was using one of those 80 to 100 pound receivers. I believe it was an NCX 300, the kind with the big rotating dial, the slide rule, and a knob that you crank to change bands, and then you get a different slide rule on each band. I mean, it was a beautiful piece of mechanical work. And the very first QSO I had, I was pretty good on CW, but there was one character that I hadn't learned yet, which was da-da-da-da-da, which happens to be a slash, a forward slash, to use the current parlance. And the operator I was talking to on 15 meters was a novice, a WB3 something, and he was signing slash KX6, but I didn't know what the slash meant. So when he told me he was in Hawaii, I was thinking, what? This guy's a three call. You know, he should be in Pennsylvania somewhere. So that was my my auspicious introduction to QSOs.
But I think by the time I met you, you were already an advanced class licensee in high school. So how did that come about?
Well, I realized right away that I wanted more spectrum. I was not happy with just being stuck in the novice bands, and the science class was actually pretty aggressive. The club was pretty aggressive in having everybody upgrade their licenses as soon as possible. So I was also doing Morse code and Boy Scouts, and I was pretty quickly up to 20 words per minute. So I actually went right through the general and then the advanced, and then I think I had the extra by the time I was 16. I had the honor of taking my extra class exam in Mission Valley at the Town and Country Hotel, and there was actually a TV crew there that day. So I had actually some TV exposure from the wrist to my fingertips because they needed somebody to send Morse code on the news segment.
Oh, that sounds great. So can you tell me what's your favorite operating mode and how did that come about?
Well, I really like CW. I'm not sure why. Maybe it harkens back to my Boy Scouts days where we had a contest called a jamboree, where you take all of the Boy Scout troops and everybody goes outdoors and you hike around and do various events. And the only event that our troop got a blue ribbon in was CW. And I think it's because I was the one who was able to copy it at reasonably high speed across a valley, by the way, using signal lights. Mm-hmm. So that was one of my early experiences with CW. But also, you know, CW has a very high signal noise ratio, both in the literal sense, signal noise as measured using equipment, but also CW has a very high signal noise ratio semantically. It uses compact abbreviations that are known worldwide. It transcends language barriers, and it, of course, transcends fading and interference. You can narrow the bandwidth down and have a lot of contacts being made in a very narrow bandwidth. It might have been PSK-31 if I had gotten started in ham radio, you know, 30 or 40 years later. But CW was the narrowband digital mode of choice when we were kids. And another thing I really like about CW is that the equipment can be very simple, straightforward. I mean, it can be as complicated as you want. Something like an Elecraft K3 or a KX3 is a good example of a radio that uses a lot of throws a lot of hardware at the CW operating problem, how to, you know, optimize for filtering, etc. But you can also use really simple equipment. So one of the very first things I ever built which really got me interested in homebrew and in QRP, was just basically a crystal oscillator. And I didn't even use a circuit board. As I mentioned earlier, I had bins full of parts laying around from TVs and radios I'd ripped apart. And all of that stuff migrated with me as we moved from Fletcher Hills to La Mesa when I was about 11. And so I dug around in that box. I found a transistor. In fact, I think I bought a transistor, probably a CK722 or some ancient thing I bought one from Heathkit, believe it or not. I claimed it was a spare part, so they sent me one right away. Mm-hmm. So I took my CK722 or maybe it was a 2N2222, which is the cockroach of transistors. Mm-hmm. And I then, twisted the leads and made an oscillator circuit and basically had this grizzled wad of parts laying there on the workbench with everything all tied together. And then I hooked up a 9-volt battery through a code key, which is definitely not a good idea if you're trying to avoid key clicks. Nonetheless, it worked. And I hooked the output of that oscillator up to, I think it was the guy wire on the existing TV antenna on the roof. And I worked a guy 200 miles away. And, I'm guessing I was probably running 100 to 200 milliwatts at the time with an untuned antenna on 40 meters. And that kind of thing, when you're 15 or 14, can really get you hooked on using CW and using low power. I later went on to turn my HT37 100-watt transmitter down to something like 200 milliwatts and was working all over the country. It was a real blast.
Well, that sounds great. And I actually do remember, I think I've made jokes with Brent and other hams that you had in mind to build a KX3, 40 years ago, but you just couldn't get enough 2N2222s to make play. But why don't you tell our audience a little bit about the Radio Shack that you had there in Mesa? I think that for a teenager to have the kind of facility that you had seemed to me it was unusual. Maybe it wasn't. But do you want to describe that a little bit?
Sure. Well, my mom remarried about the time I got my first license. And my stepfather was a really wise guy. And he recognized that my interest in radio was the kind of thing that could be so distracting that it would probably keep me off the streets, and keep me from doing all the usual crazy stuff that the teenage boys did in the early 1970s. And he turned out to be right. I was so preoccupied with building things in the Radio Shack that I managed to spend a good chunk of my time doing that. It was a little bit of guitar and a little bit of girls and a little bit of snorkeling and camping trips. But, for the most part, I was very interested in heading out to my little private enclave and designing things, experimenting, et cetera. And so he wanted to make it even easier for me to escape the real world and do my thing. And so he offered to build an outdoor shed just for the shack. So I had a 10 by 10 foot metal building that we probably bought at Sears, and we put it together, built workbenches, and it was Teen Ham's dream come true. Of course, later on, I dreamed up the idea of bugging my sister's room, and I had an amplifier, an audio amplifier, bolted underneath the workbench I could plug my headphones into, and I literally had wires routed to a microphone up through the house, through the attic, and into her air vent. And she has forgiven me for that, but partly because I never heard anything of substance. She talked to her girlfriends endlessly, and it turned out to be way more boring than being on the air.
Yeah, I seem to recall that. I seem to recall it, but, she obviously didn't know that any of your friends ever listened as well. So you survived that part of your childhood. Did you have any Elmers who were influential in bringing you along in your teenage years?
Sure. Well, there was the team of Roger Miller and Dick Loeffler. Dick's call was WA6COE, I believe. I can't recall Roger's call sign. They're probably both SKs by now. But they were both instrumental in bringing a whole class full of us into amateur radio. And they, of course, maintained you know, that great shack on campus. We still have photos in the junior high yearbook of the radio club, and I'm sure that that those two gentlemen are in the photo. So that was those are the first two guys I would call Elmers. Had another one, a guy named Ben, who lived up the street from me. I believe his call was K6MBN, possibly K5MBN. You know, somebody listening to this is going to correct me, so that's fine. So the way I met Ben was that I was using a Heathkit DX20, not necessarily the most well-filtered transmitter in the world. And to complicate matters, the coax cable in the attic of our house for the cable TV line had a break in it. I didn't know this, but my transmitter antenna was like practically on top of the community's cable TV coax. And so Ben was able to copy my call sign directly off of his TV several blocks away. And so he came down and literally just knocked on the door and introduced himself with his Texan accent. And, you know, he was quite an endearing and friendly guy. And so he took myself and a couple of my buddies from high school, including Rick Dewey and probably Carl Crawford. We all headed up to his house, three blocks from mine, and got to see what a real shack looked like. He had some great gear, including a spectrum scope. Actually, it wasn't a spectrum scope. It was a waveform scope for monitoring a transmit signal. But it was the state of the art at the time. So Ben was a great guy. And later on, he moved up to, I think, Poway and had a very, or Ramona someplace. Anyway, he had a very serious antenna system. And we had a great time using his gear with serious antennas.
What effect did amateur radio have on your post-high school life? Where did you go?
Well, I would say not a whole lot early on. I joined the Coast Guard and went into, got a lot of electronic technician training through the Coast Guard and went to the engineering center in Wildwood, New Jersey, which was mostly preoccupied with Loran C and Omega navigation aids. And that was a great time. I was, 19 at the time. I was so preoccupied with that there wasn't a whole lot of time for radio. But actually, I did spend a year in Bermuda. And while I was there, that's when I applied for a two-letter call. And they had just changed the rule, so you didn't have to be a ham for 20 years in order to get a two-letter call. And you just needed to have an extra class license. So I applied for several different call signs, and I got N6KR, which I thought would be a great CW call, which it is. And I did meet several hams who lived in Bermuda, and they all lived in exotic-sounding places at the end of long, winding roads. Like, you know, one guy lived in a house that didn't have an address. It was just called Silver End. And so I spent quite a bit of time hanging out with the guys who lived in Bermuda and had British accents. And it was all very exotic and surreal for me. And I had a little shack set up at the Coast Guard base. But again, throughout that entire period, I was more or less preoccupied with the Coast Guard and just sort of coming of age issues and work. So later on, though, I became very busy with college and, met my future wife and didn't really do a whole lot with amateur radio until I think it was 1982. I guess I was 25 or so at the time. And that's when I wrote my very first article. I had a Heathkit HW8 that normally covers 80, 40, 20, and 15 meters. And I modified the 80-meter band for 30 meters instead, which at the time was a new band, and wrote a little article that showed up in QST. And sort of I kind of got hooked on being a technical author at that time.
Well, your you know, as a technical person, you have an unusual college background. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Well, I started off more or less with a, you know, the usual junior college path where, you know, this is very typical of Californians. You can take a lot of liberal arts courses and the usual math and physics and chemistry, et cetera. And then you can use that to transfer to a four-year college. And that actually reduces the cost of a four-year college education by a huge amount. So, and since I was kind of a vagabond at the time, when I got out of the Coast Guard, I was on a GI Bill and I moved around quite a bit. And I actually spent a good portion of my my first 2 years in college in at Grossmont College in San Diego and also at Santa Barbara City College, Santa Barbara. And, you know, more or less having a good time, taking classes part-time, et cetera. And then by the time I got back to San Diego and was ready to transfer to UCSD, the University of California, San Diego, which is in La Jolla, I really was interested in a lot more things than just electronics. And the thing that caught my fancy was a degree program called cognitive science, which at the time I was there was administered through the psychology department. Now there's a much larger cognitive science department, as you can imagine, with, you know, the emphasis these days on artificial intelligence and natural language processing, things like Siri. You know, this whole field has exploded since I was at UCSD. But those are the early days of parallel distributed processing and neural networks and cognitive engineering and genetic algorithms. And so I had a really interesting couple of years at UCSD and graduated with a degree in cognitive science. So it's not, I mean, it did have a computer science core curriculum, and a lot of what I have done since then is firmware engineering and user interface design. So it those are aspects of design that are very pertinent to amateur radio. But I have to say that the RF engineering portion of my activities was pretty much self-taught or just, you know, school of hard knocks.
Well, I have to tell you that, and you know this, that I, you know, it was a male bonding exercise with you when I bought a K2 about 12, 13 years ago. And I'm putting together the control board. And the control board mates into the RF board, you know, as you know, with a connector. And when you put the screw head that holds the RF board down on the chassis, and then you plug the control board into it, you put a hole in the control board so that if you take an Allen wrench, you could use the screw on the bottom, you know, on the RF board to pry the control board out of the socket. Do you remember this?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
so as soon as I did that, I said, cognitive science, right?
Yeah, well, you know, I think maybe the truth is I'm actually a sort of frustrated mechanical engineer. Uh-huh. In fact, I do a lot of the mechanical engineering for Elecraft. We have an outstanding, you know, well-trained mechanical engineer. But before he came along, I was pretty much doing all of the sheet metal design and had to come up with little tricks like the ones you just described. And, you know, my mechanical engineering, you know, a sort of OJT, on-the-job training, has arisen, you know, because of the mother of necessity rule. And also because we have a tendency at Elecraft to try and make things as small as possible. And as a result, you design yourself into some very interesting corners and you end up with some very interesting solutions when in the future, customers who own a particular product say, hey, can we do this? And, you know, we look at it and we say, well, we didn't think of that from the beginning, but maybe we could do that. And then we find a way to shoehorn something in. So a good example of that is the K2's DSP board. We have an option for the K2 called the KDSP2. So there was never any plan originally to put DSP into the K2, but a gentleman by the name of Lyle Johnson, who I work with every day, and is one of our, you know, engineering staff members. He decided he would reverse engineer the audio filter, the analog audio filter option that we have for the K2, and then figure out how to insert the DSP board in at that point. And it turned out that we had enough hooks and enough space in there so that he was able to build his own DSP module. And then he contacted us and said, hey, you want DSP in the K2? And he said, I'm thinking about selling these. And so we loved it. So we hired him and took the KDSP2 on as a project. But that's just one of many examples of how, you know, our customers, you know, help us figure out what we're going to put into the radios next. And so far, we've been lucky and we've left just enough room to get things inside that people wanted. Another good example is the 2-meter module in the KX3. It's the size of a credit card, and we really weren't sure if we were going to be able to do it. We left just barely enough room in there to screw the tab down on the TO220 power amplifier device. And we left just enough room in there for our VHF, UHF engineer to create this little transverter module. So this is a part of our overall effort to use every last centimeter of volume inside the radios.
Well, I want to go down the Elecraft rabbit hole. But before we do that, you had an interesting stint in the Bay Area. You want to talk a little bit about where you went after your degree and what that turned into?
Well, sure. So my wife, who was my future wife at the time, and I moved from California to Massachusetts, and she was getting her master's degree at the Rhode Island School of Design while I was busy learning how to do an entirely different kind of firmware from anything I'd ever done before, which had to do with networking. So this was all about terminal servers and routers and bridges. And when she graduated, we looked at the map of the Bay Area, because we both were interested in Northern California, or at least farther north than San Diego, for cultural reasons. And it just seemed like a good fit for us, because we knew that, you know, her degree in graphic design and, you know, my technology emphasis would probably give us some good opportunities there. So we literally got a map out of the Bay Area, and we drew a line between San Francisco and what we thought was, you know, the heart of Silicon Valley, probably Palo Alto. We drew a line right down the middle and bisected it, and that put us in San Carlos and Belmont. And so when she graduated, we started looking for job opportunities in Silicon Valley and in San Francisco, and we both found those opportunities, and we moved to San Carlos and then later to Belmont, right in the middle between those two areas, and turned out to be just the perfect move for us. And the place that I ended up was a research company called Interval Research, which was owned and funded by Paul Allen of Microsoft fame. And we were charged with designing the future. Interval Research got started just before the web happened, and a whole lot of new technology associated with the web and the telecommunications, et cetera. So we, at least from my perspective, didn't quite catch the wave at the right time. And I was at Interval Research working with some really serious researchers, some luminaries in multiple fields, and had a great time there. We had, you know, amazing speakers. We were all good friends with an amazing extended family, including musicians like Stanley Jordan. And we were doing some very cool stuff, but about 8 years into that, I really started getting the bug. I wanted to do something that was a little less prospective and a little more grounded. And so it was about that time that I realized I wanted to start my own company, and the right guy came along at the right time, and that's Eric Swartz, WA6HHQ. But my time at Interval was really transformative. I learned a huge amount from that. I met many, many people who turned out to be great contacts for the latter part of my career.
Did your stint at Interval have any effect on the I think it was in parallel. I mean, if I remember the timeline, when you were starting to build QRP transceivers for backpackers.
Well, a couple of things come to mind. One is that I learned to use a lot of really interesting computer-aided design tools when I was at Interval Research, and I brought that knowledge with me. So, for example, for a long time, I was using a couple of Mac programs, one of which is McDraw Pro. I still have hundreds of McDraw Pro drawings, which represent all of the early equipment that I built at both Interval and then later on for Elecraft. It just happens to be a really easy to use 2D drawing program, full color and gradients and all that. And it was just a great tool. Unfortunately, it's not supported anymore. And, you know, I'm having to migrate to other platforms. But the other tool that I used a lot in the early days was something called McCAD, cross-platform PC layout and schematic capture program. And I still have, again, a lot of designs there, but we're now migrating all of that to more modern platforms. And me, you know, I'm trying to get out of the PC board business. I've got enough engineers now on staff that they would prefer that I not get into that. So all my old designs are getting upgraded, and we're having a good time with much more sophisticated tools. Let's see. While I'm on the subject of tools, I should mention that my favorite tool these days is something called SketchUp, which is a free 3D modeling package that runs on Macs and PCs. And I started using it to design a second story addition for our house, and then realized that I could use it for product design also. So all of my new designs start as 3D SketchUp models, and then they get handed off to the mechanical engineer and to the rest of our engineering staff, and we pick it apart, and then I do another release. And so it's really fun doing stuff in three dimensions. I really never thought that I would get into that, but you know, like I said, I'm kind of a late starting mechanical engineer. Actually, it's quite a bit of fun to do designs in three dimensions and to create mechanical assemblies and see how they all fit together before you actually commit to thousands of dollars of fabrication tooling.
Let's go back a little bit to your QRP backpacker transceivers. You, I remember seeing something that you brought to my house in Denver in about 1982, I think 83, maybe a little bit later. But you were building transceivers for a club, I think, over in the Bay Area. Is that right?
Well, what happened was, when I moved back to California with my wife, one of the things I was interested in was finding a vehicle through which I could continue exploring my own QRP designs, etc. I had done quite a few little radios like the one I showed you in Denver, you know, little tiny things that are maybe 2x4x1 inches, the size of a small HT, and have an internal battery, a little key on the top, you know, maybe crystal controlled, the VCXO. And those were all really fun projects, but I really wanted to take those designs to another level. And the motivation for that for me was to have other people build them and give me feedback on them and then, you know, move on from there. So about the time we moved back to California, I started looking into QRP clubs just to see if there might be a large contingent of people who were interested in building things and operating low power backpacking radios. And there really didn't seem to be anything local at the time. So I contacted one of the larger QRP clubs in the world, which is QRP ARCI, QRP Amateur Radio Club International. They've been around since the 60s, I believe. And I asked them if they knew of anybody who might be interested in starting a QRP club in Northern California. And it just so happened that Doug Hendricks, KI6DS, had been thinking the very same thing. And he had asked them for their California roster. And I asked them for their California roster. And to make a long, really long story short, we decided together that we would start a club. So Doug was NorCal QRP club number one, and then Jim Cates, WA6GER, was number two, or maybe I have those two backwards. And then I was NorCal QRP club number three. And this all came to fruition at a swap meet or flea market in Livermore, California. That was the official first meeting of the NorCal QRP club. And I think we inducted eight members at that time. And one of them was Bob Dyer, K6KK, who went on to be the owner and operator of Wilderness Radio. He basically took, some of my NorCal QRP club designs, and like the NorCal 40 and the Sierra, the SST, and commercialized them. So Bob and I have had a great working relationship, and he continues to sell those little radio kits to this day. But the kit that got the whole thing started was the NorCal 40, which is a little 40-meter transceiver that puts out about 2 or 3 watts. So there's actually a funny story with that, because the day of that club meeting at the Livermore swap meet, some of us then decided to go off and have lunch, and so we're all sitting around a table at McDonald's, and so Doug says, so what are we going to do for a club project? And I then popped up and volunteered to design a 40-meter rig that was specifically targeted as a club project. And what's really funny about that is that at the time, we were trying to decide whether we should kit 25 of these or maybe 50, really stick our neck out. Well, ultimately, the NorCal 40A in the club form sold in the low thousands, and through Wilderness Radio, multiple thousands. And it's been a very successful little radio. So that's one of the things that helped kick the club off. And then there were other designers who came in and did great club projects. And in fact, there was just a kind of pre-Cambrian explosion of QRP clubs and projects over that time with some very talented designers. The New Jersey QRP club comes to mind. A lot of those folks get together at an event called 4 Days in May at Dayton every year, Dayton, Ohio, where we have the big hamvention. So Eric Swartz and I and many of the club members have benefited from this huge gathering where we all get together and compare our rigs. And, I like to think of the NorCal 40 as one of the progenitors of that. The NorCal 40 also has another interesting distinction in that a college professor named David Rutledge at Caltech in California decided that the NorCal 40 was a potentially useful vehicle for his own electronics class that he taught at Caltech called EE20, the electronics of radio. And so he put a class together based on the NorCal 40, and he wrote a lab workbook that became a 400-page hardbound textbook that you can actually buy on Amazon. All of the proceeds, of course, go to Caltech. And then he even exported this EE20 course to other colleges and universities around the country. So I don't know how many there are, but every year Bob Dyer provides a whole lot of NorCal 40 PC boards to colleges and universities, and they have licensed countless people through taking the EE20 class that was based on the NorCal 20 or NorCal 40. So that's been a lot of fun.
That's amazing. So tell me then. Now we can go down the Elecraft tunnel. So how did that come about? What's interesting, what you might point out is Eric's call sign is WA6HHQ, and as I remember, your call sign before N6KR was WA6HQH. So
right. Now, if I were superstitious or maybe religious, I might look at that and say, "Wow, we were fated to start a company together." It's merely a fluke of statistics that we have call signs that use the same letters back
Absolutely.
In those days. It just means that he and I are about the same age, and we got our calls about the same time. In fact, we are very close to the same age. And Eric still uses that call, WA6HHQ. He's always thought it was a very cool call sign, and he has a lot of name and call recognition, so he's not anxious to change it. HQH, I don't know, I always felt that it was kind of a mouthful and a liability on both CW and sideband. So anyhow, the way this all started was that Eric Swartz had gotten a hold of one of my NorCal 40 kits from a club, and he had joined the club. And, you know, Eric has a double E degree and some business background, and he's a very smart guy. And so he decided that he was going to put his NorCal 40 on steroids. So he beefed it up to something like 5 watts. And then he proceeded to work 100 countries on that thing, running somewhere between 3 and 5 watts. And he, I believe, had a 40-meter beam, a two-element beam, I think. This is going way back. But he then called me, you know, and was, you know, not exactly bragging, but he was so happy with the radio. And you know, I was just flabbergasted that he had worked 100 countries on 40 meters from California using 5 watts. So we struck up a friendship, and we started doing field day together. And so we, you know, I think we did a field day with the NorCal 40s, and then the Sierra came along, and that was my first serious multiband design. The Sierra was, again, a NorCal Club project. They used removable band modules. You could just plug in to cover 160 through 10 meters. And so Eric and I started doing field day with the Sierras. And, you know, 1 year we were, I think it was 96, we were at field day, and, you know, we were sitting there in my VW van, and we've got a couple of the Sierras, and we are, you know, like dealing with all of the external equipment involved, including the keyers and the automatic antenna tuners and the batteries and, you know, antenna switches and all of this cumulative stuff that you need in order to have two stations running at field day, or at least have, you know, be able to operate on multiple bands. And, you know, we're just kind of scratching our heads and thinking there's got to be a better way to do this. So we literally started, you know, doing designs on the backs of napkins there in the van. That's all we had. And we were sketching out the K2, which our target was to do something that was an all band, sideband, and CW radio. And so we thought we had a pretty good design in mind. And so he and I both started doing prototyping of different parts of it independently. And I did the prototype sheet metal for it, and we put it all together. And, you know, long before we got it done, we did an interesting thing, which is we went to PacificCon that year. I think it was late 96, October 96. And we had a kind of mystery presentation. And we, to a packed house, we basically announced our intention to start Elecraft. And we held up an older multiband radio that I designed called the Safari 4. And we said, so this is, you know, like existing tech, or old tech, and we're going to do something that's much more exciting. And then we held up a foam core mock-up of the K2, full size, with color printouts attached to the sides of the foam core body, so that it really looked like the radio, and got a round of applause for that. And I think that of the people in that room that day, many, many of them were NorCal members, and many of them went on to become our first round of K2 builders. But another thing that helped kick off the K2 was that Eric and I were walking down the beach one day, and we were thinking about how successful at the time the Windows and DOS PC world had been with, you know, construction of personal computers based on components that you put together. You know, plug them into a motherboard, put the motherboard into a frame, add a power supply, hook up a keyboard and a monitor, and you got your own computer that didn't cost very much. So one of the ideas that was central to the K2 was the idea of removable and upgradable modules. And in fact, a K2 that's fully loaded has, you know, something like 10 PC boards in it. And many of them are option modules with their own little microcontroller. So that model of modularity and extensibility is something that we have carried forward all the way through to our current products.
Well, I especially like the ability to pull the side panel off. You know, the way you've built the case, you can pull the side panel off and you can poke in there if you need to get to something without taking the whole thing apart. So, it's a beautiful radio. So where did it go from there? I mean, so you pulled up this this foam model. All of a sudden you realize that you want to build kits or that you want to...
Yeah. Well, you know, the idea of making kits is partly just because that's the path that I came up from. I mean, I had built many Heath kits and debugged many of my own Heath kits. And I knew that there was just a certain ambiance, you know, to kit building that's a little different from operating a radio that you didn't build yourself. And, of course, Heathkit sold only kit transceivers. They did assemble some other things, but not their ham gear. It was you had to build it. I built an HW16. I had friends who built HW101s. And, you know, so we kind of all grew up with this notion of kits. Mm-hmm. And then of course, NorCal QRP Club and other clubs came along, and I was heavily involved in kits for that. So it just seemed like a natural for us to try and pick up where Heathkit had left off. And Heathkit, you know, had sort of, you know, faded out from the amateur radio scene several years before that. So we felt like there was an opportunity there. And so it turns out that when you design kits, you get some unfair advantages, Eric likes to call them. And one of them is that the people who build kits are very technically inclined, and so they they're very resilient when it comes to testing prototypes and offering feedback on new features. You know, if you're selling fully assembled radios that are basically a done deal, then the users are not necessarily as willing to go along with the gag if there's a problem. So, you know, we have a tendency to ship the kits early, even before all the firmware is done and before all the option modules have been decided. And then we try to involve customers in the process, not just of building them, but also in, you know, deciding what comes next and what features we want to add in firmware. And it's that aspect of the hobby that I think is central to Elecraft's success. We have a kind of a diaspora of kit builders and builders become Elmers who then help new customers when they have issues. And we get just an amazing amount of feedback. I probably spend half my day every day as the CTO just gathering information from builders and owners of Elecraft gear and, you know, figuring out what they want next and, you know, how to solve their technical problems. And it's a very kind of, you know, rich environment that's much more social and intriguing to the customers, and by extension keeps us really hopping than if we were a more or less static entity that sold only fully assembled radios.
Well, I think obviously that's what makes Elecraft so unique, where you're actually shipping a minimum viable product and then using the user base to fine tune it. I think it's a great idea. But it appears to me that strategy is changing. Obviously, in order to pack as many features as you've packed into the KX3, you've had to kind of go beyond a kit builder's ability to perhaps, handle surface mount components and pack it in real tight. Is that's not necessarily a change, is it, in the company in terms of its direction? Or, do you see other through-hole component projects coming up in the future to keep your hand kit building?
I think we're still trying to provide, you know, full kits where we can. We have a number of mini modules that are what we call full kits, where you get to install all of the parts and you get to wind all of the inductors if they're involved. And then we have the K2, which we're still selling with all of its options. I mean, the K2 is almost a 15-year-old design, and yet we still are able to get all of the through-hole parts for that kit. It's a kind of kit that takes maybe 30 hours to put together. There are still plenty of people who want to build a full kit, a la Heathkit. But the competitive nature of the industry is that if you want to build a radio that is competitive in terms of features, performance, and form factor, that's a big one for people, then you really have no choice but to use surface mount parts, and a lot of them. And surface mount parts are, in many cases, at a size that becomes difficult to even see and pick up. And so a long time ago, I realized that there was kind of a threshold of creativity somewhere between surface mount parts and leaded parts. And, about the time you start getting to a part that's smaller than an 0805, which is something you can easily hold with tweezers, you go much smaller than that, and now there's a substantial contingent of the potential user base or the potential creators of the projects who are going to have some difficulty, especially as they get older, manipulating those parts and installing them and making sure that all the pins are soldered, etc. So what we decided was that in order for us to achieve the next level of performance and integration and still keep the size of our radios down, because portability is very important to us, we decided that we would introduce something called the no soldering kit. And we kicked that off with the Elecraft K3, which we started shipping in 2008. And the K3 has a number of PC boards, but they are all pre-assembled at the factory, and they are pre-tested, pre-aligned, and so that you're guaranteed that when you put your kit together, which still involves quite a bit of time, because you've got scads of hardware and knobs and feet and chassis pieces, PC boards, and you use the built-in test equipment to align it. But it still takes a considerable amount of time, and you learn a lot about how the radio works. You learn about what the different modules do. It's something that makes the kit a lot more accessible to a much wider range of builders. Now, I do want to say that there is definitely a place for surface mount kits. And in fact, as I mentioned, we've got this rich collection of homebrew and QRP clubs around the country, and they have many, many projects, lots of which can be purchased through their websites. And these kits, some of them are very, very simple, kind of along the lines of the Ramsey kits or the old Tentec kits. And then there are some that are quite a bit more sophisticated. But it turns out that if you really look at it, it turns out that that anything that requires a lot of surface mount parts has kind of diminishing returns for the manufacturer, because a lot of people will make one mistake and then not be able to figure out what the problem is, and they'll either have to send it back in for troubleshooting, or they will simply not use it and they'll move on to the next project. And that's just really frustrating for both the users of the kits and for the company. So we don't have any full surface mount kits ourselves. I mean, I can imagine we might do that in the future, but there are just certain parts that are nearly impossible to solder. I mean, I'm pretty good at it, but I shy away from it. At our factory, we have specialized equipment for soldering the parts down and making sure that they're soldered perfectly, and then we use lots and lots of firmware test code in order to make sure that that everything is installed perfectly and everything's going to work when it gets into the customer's hands. We do very extensive testing and burn-in. And this is just par for the course with surface mount assemblies.
Well, as it appears that amateur radio numbers are increasing. Thankfully, I keep thinking it's because of Hurricane Katrina, and the fact that people discover that all of this infrastructure that we use can disappear very rapidly, and amateur radio saves the day. But where do you feel that the amateur radio technology is evolving to? What do you see? What do you see as a transceivers that amateurs will be working with in the next 20 years?
Well, I mean, at one level, I think that hams will be hams, and they will continue doing what they've been doing for decades, and that's using what they already have and what they like. Because when it comes down to it, you know, amateur radio really is about the act of communications. It's you know, some people think of it as entertainment. Some people find it, you know, it has nostalgic value or friendship value, or just the allure of working DX or running stations in a contest. Or for me, for example, it's field day, it's backpacking. All of those activities are very well supported by existing equipment. So when you ask where is the equipment going, you kind of have to, you know, ask, you know, what are the boundaries between amateur radio and other aspects of communications and even entertainment that people are interested in, and also education. You know, hams learn a lot from building their gear, from using it, and understanding how it works. So it's really hard to say, but I would say a good contingent will continue using the equipment they have, and will continue just enjoying all of the activities they have historically. In the case of Elecraft gear, we have, you know, been over backwards to try and make sure that we supply the kind of equipment that is going to be used, or that's going to be extremely advantageous for things like field day and for de-expeditions, both large and small. I mean, it's safe to say that a large percentage of de-expeditions these days use either K3s or KX3s, or in some cases even K2s. And I think the reason is because, you know, it's a lot of performance in a small package. And, you know, looking at product reviews, you know, it's pretty clear that our customers really like the lightweight, the small form factor, and the low current drain of all of our gear. Of course, you can really extend it and outfit a station that has a lot more affordances to it. So, for example, we have something called the K-Line, where it's an Elecraft K3, maybe a P3 pan adapter, and a KPA500 amplifier. And then we have our smaller line, which is the KX line, which is the KX3 and now the PX3 pan adapter and the KX-PA100 amplifier. So it's a kind of orthogonal approach to designing these entire lineups of products. And so I think Elecraft will continue to, you know, to evolve in that direction where we provide, you know, a unified, integrated solution and focus on really what it is that people like to do. Now, there is another whole category of question here, and that is, where's the boundary between a computer and a radio? And the way we've always looked at this is that while a computer can provide some extensions to the radio, it really isn't a substitute for the radio. So we have... obviously, there are manufacturers who create so-called black box radios that basically just sit next to the computer and everything's tied into them, and you just do all of your operating at the computer. Personally, I find that a less satisfying mode of operation. I like the degree of immersion that you get by having the radio and its spectral display right there in front of you, where you can quickly manipulate controls. That turns out to be a big advantage for certain kinds of operation where, you know, you want to respond quickly to on-air conditions. And, you know, just to be frank, I kind of get tired of using a mouse in order to interact with the rest of the world. I spend enough time doing that I kind of like getting back to my radio with its pretty intimate user interface. And a lot of our customers have told us exactly the same thing. So we're in no hurry to attempt to move the user interface to the computer as some of our competitors have.
Well, I think I agree with you there. I like the tactile experience of turning the knob and you know, going up and down the band. It seems more natural than trying to do it with my computer. Anyway, Wayne, you've been a wonderful guest, and I know that you and I could go on for hours, and And I think that we'll just have to invite you back in the future to talk more about ham radio and about what you're doing at Elecraft and what's in the future for your company and for Wayne Burdick. So
that's great. Yeah, and I really appreciate the opportunity to come on your show, Eric. And I know you haven't been doing this for very long, but you're doing a great job. It's a very professionally run, considering how little experience you've had doing it. So good luck with the program. And actually, you know, we got to get you back here in the United States. So next time you come to California, look us up.
Well, I have hopes that QSO Today will give me the opportunity to go back to the States and even do field day once again. I remember then where we did field day. I think it was in 1972, I think it was.
That might have been the very first one that I ever did.
Uh-huh. And we get up there to the El Cajon Amateur Radio Club site. I think it was on a hill on the site of near Julian, and we're ready to operate radios, and they hand us two weed whackers and tell us to clear about 20 acres of dry grass in order to make room for the tents.
That's right. That's right. We cut our teeth on the El Cajon Radio Club's field day adventure. And I mean, I remember that's when I learned how to strip the braid and put a PL-259 onto a piece of RG-8. Yeah, field day is a great equalizer and a great way to learn about the real world.
Well, I look forward to it, and I look forward to being back there with you in person. So 73, Wayne, we'll catch you again.
Okay. Okay, Eric, take care, 73s.
Well, that wraps our show with Wayne, N6KR. I hope you found our QSO Today interesting and as fun as I did. Please go to the QSO Today website at www.qsotoday.com to see the show notes for this episode 11. Wayne is also an accomplished poet and gave me two of his poems to post on his show notes page. Both poems are ham radio related and will strike a chord with a contester and home brewer. In addition, if you have not already joined QSO Today community, Wayne has offered our community a white paper on the contents of his 10-pound de-expedition go bag. Press the sign-up button on the podcast page of the QSO Today website, and I will send it to you. If you are already a member of our community, you will receive it in the email automatically. As a member, you can join our QSO Today Facebook group, where you can interact with our community to be an Elmer or be Elmered by someone else. I promise not to spam you or give your email address to anyone. Finally, I appreciate all of you who listen to the QSO Today podcast from all over the world. I am interested in ham radio stories. If you want to recommend someone to be on QSO Today, please send me a message through the contact form on the QSO Today website or through my QRZ page under 4Z1UG. That's all for now. This is Eric, 4Z1UG, 73.